Wednesday, May 9th, 2007, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5513, the Department of Fish and Wildlife budget bill. I hear yesterday that I was gone and the committee took the day off.
Wouldn't exactly put it that way. We passed about 30 bills yesterday.
But with that, why don't we go ahead and get started.
Thank you, Chair Darrellman. For the record, my name is Virgil Moore. I'm Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. It's good to be back here today. We left off pretty much toward the end of the presentation that I had given, and I'll finish up here in about 5 minutes and then pass the baton over to Lori Byerly. We were talking efficiencies on Monday, and where we sort of left off was talking about how we're doing efficiency and quality improvement in the organization. One of the items that we're working on is leveraging technology. We're looking at ways to do better in the field with technology. We're trying to expand smart consumption. We've done an awful lot of stuff that has reduced things a little bit. And there's a whole list of items under concept number 2 on page 25 in your book that talks about some of the ways that we have found smart ways to do the same thing we're doing now. We could fill a book full of those, but they do add up, and they're good things to do, and the staff has really been effective at that. Some of the bigger things we're looking at is work vehicles and how to better use those work vehicles and smaller vehicles and manage our fleet a little better. Fiscal responsibility and accountability through agency actions. That's the responsible and accountable actions that we talked about a little bit. One of the big things we've been doing is because our revenue string, as we talked about on Monday, is at the end of its life cycle, we have to track our revenue very closely to be sure that it stays on target. We do our projections much like the legislature does and have to monitor license sales. And we're going to monthly cash flow and revenue reports. We give those to the commission. We monitor that very closely so we can adjust within the limitation that the legislature has given us to be sure we don't exceed our revenue strength. And that is an item that the administrative folks are working very diligently on to provide us as managers down to the individual program level so that each person in the department that controls a budget can monitor real-time what's going on and adjust their cash flow based on management revenue projections and holdbacks. The last item, and I'm on... In terms of the slides here, there's the last page on page 22. We talked a little bit Friday about the prioritized actions. These came from our advisory committee, budget advisory committees that we had a year and a half ago, and they gave us 5 items that they said were top priority actions. Those were fish management, wildlife management, enforcement, hatchery production, and marine resources. We use that information to come up with the 10% reduction list, which fills a fair part of the book you've got, starting on page 26 and going to, page 60 or something like that. Or actually, starts on page 30. And these are prioritized actions, and we use the information we got from the public, our own internal criteria, to work through each and individual program there to give it a priority ranking for the 10% reduction list we were asked to provide. We eliminated entire positions and programs, though, instead of thinning the soup, because we don't have much soup to thin. We don't have the free fund budget balance, and the only way we can begin to reduce when we don't have that, and we've squeezed this biennium we're in right now, we've squeezed things pretty tight, is to begin looking at taking bigger chunks out so we can essentially get at positions and programs. It's one of the last things that I want to do because the most important asset we have in the organization is our staff, and it's the one that we should protect more than anything else. But at some point, That's also one of the most expensive things we've got, and we're going to have to go after some staff positions on a prioritized basis, which is what's reflected in here as you go through. We are looking at both localized, regional, and statewide impacts, and we're looking at how these reductions, if we have to implement them, affects us in the future as well as today. And essentially, that completes my portion of the presentation, bringing us up to the 10% reduction list. And I know there's a tremendous amount of information in that list, and but hopefully we won't have to use it. We went through the exercise, but it's one of those that we hope we never have to get into.
I have one question. Being dependent upon licenses for a large portion of your budget on the fishing side, does it put you in an interesting position when you're limiting seasons? unless you actually always sell the licenses before you announce that you've limited the season.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee. You know, that's always one of the things that folks say is that because we are generating our revenue that keeps our agency going, that we may be more liberal with licenses or seasons or bags than we should be to generate revenue. We hear that. I'm getting carried away here. You hear that often. The way we do our process, though, with the public, with the commission, and the professional review that has a science and a biological base to it, this has been reviewed in a number of states over the years to see whether that bias is creating. It doesn't. I'm not familiar enough with all the processes in Oregon yet because of my short tenure here to say for sure that's the case, but I do know it's been evaluated heavily in other states.
I wouldn't be as concerned about the bias as the interesting thing that probably for good reasons you might have to limit seasons. In some cases, of course, I hear from a lot of sports fishermen that sometimes seasons are so limited
yes.
that there isn't any practical reason to want to go buy all this equipment. Plus paying for the licensing beyond that for something that you really can't you really have a extremely short period of time in which to actually enjoy the activity.
Chair Devlin, you're absolutely correct. We do know that seasons based on biological needs, the short seasons that we open and close very quickly, or delayed seasons that are driven by particularly salmon runs that are constrained do affect people buying both equipment and licenses. We see that in that license sale. Some of those spikes up and down that you see in that license sales graph we showed are a result of that.
I just thought it was interesting the night that we did the hearing at Oregon State University, which you had to be at another hearing.
Yes.
Which I believe was on the split in terms of gill netters and sports fishermen.
Yes, sir.
Which about three of us about a year earlier had attended a meeting we were invited to with about 200 sports fishermen who were upset about your decision in the previous year. Maybe not. You were with the agency by that time.
Not at that point.
You weren't at that point, but
I will be this time.
You will be this time. Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
As you look through that 10% reduction in the general fund, the impact on hatcheries is very evident. Could you comment on that from the standpoint of where it's going to take us?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrard, one of the reasons you see a lot of hatcheries in there is hatcheries have one of the largest operating costs in terms of the proportion of the budget that has operating to staff. Fish feed and the transportation costs are high. And so hatcheries often, because they're such a large portion of the budget, get prioritized in here. Each of those hatcheries has a quantified benefit to sport fishing. We can tell you how that hatchery's releases perform and what they provide in terms of the sport fishing opportunity. Our prioritized list tries to minimize that. At the same time, look at the facility in terms of its cost versus its production, and move after them in that prioritized manner. The bottom line, there is both an impact to the recreational and commercial fishermen, and there's an economic impact to the state, and an impact to the agency in terms of license sales, like the chair was questioning on just a few minutes ago.
Yes. And you're going to be losing some matching federal funds, too. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrard, yes. Every license that we don't sell results in us not getting our share of the federal matching money that's out there. Each fishing license is worth somewhere around $10 to $12. A hunting license, I believe, is 8 to 10. I'd have to divide those numbers out, but it's a formula based on the number of licenses we sell and the surface area of the state. Since the state's surface area stays the same, but basically the variable here is license sales.
Please proceed to the next area.
Okay.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Lori Byerly, Deputy Director for Administration at the Department of Fish and Wildlife. The first thing I wanted to do this morning was provide you a replacement page for your presentation binder. We had a couple graphs that were not they were out of whack, so she the second thing I wanted to do is we didn't have a chance. I wanted to point out a couple items that are in your presentation binder. So in the first part of that information is all of our budgeted programs and a lot of detail on our programs and information. At the end of the book, under the number tabs, are some additional pieces of information that were in part brought up in our earlier session back in January. I just wanted to let you know what's in here in case this is information you're interested in. We have our performance measure information under tab 1. We've got some efficiency information, our detailed list of priorities under tab 3. And then under tab 4 is a detailed report on license sale trends. I know this was an issue that came up in January. We've had questions about that. It may be a report that you want to look at. It's got some good information about license trends, sales trends for both angling and hunting, and kind of what they've been doing, not only in Oregon, but in other western states. Tab number 5 has a description of our dedicated and obligated funds. We've got a lot of funds that are dedicated for very specific programs, and that provides some background on how those funds are used and what they're allowed to be used for. Tab number 6 has a write-up about the fee increase issues we've been working with in the current biennium. We're looking out to 09-11 to kind of see what level of increase we may have to request to try and maintain programs. There's some background under that tab. We also talked about the move of the Salem of the agency headquarters from Portland to Salem. There's some background information under tab 7. On that same note, on Monday, we had a little bit of discussion about the lease for the new building and what that cost was. We went back and checked to see how we compare as far as square footage rates currently with both gas uniform rent rate and current commercial rates in Salem. Our monthly per square footage cost is about $1.63 projected for 07-09. The DAS uniform rent rate is $1.36. So DAS is significantly lower than our private sector per square footage rate. The commercial rate in Salem right now is running about $1.46. At the time that the agency entertained the move from Portland to Salem, both the commercial rate was compared with what we were getting in our lease. And back in 2002, when that lease was negotiated, the square footage rate we were paying was $1.49, and the market at that point in time was $1.60. So at the time the lease was negotiated, it was under the regular commercial rate in Salem. But that's changed in the last 3 to 4 years with changes in the commercial market. So right now our rate is currently higher than what we pay potentially in a new lease situation. We took a look at the numbers. We pay about $2.8 million a biennium in rent for that facility. It's over 70,000 square feet. If we were in a building on the mall paying the DAS uniform rent rate, we'd pay about $400,000 less a year, biennium. So it would be a savings to us if we were located on the Capitol Mall paying uniform rent rate. Does that address some of the issues you had, Representative Dinkfelder, Chair Devlin?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I guess the other question would be purchasing, the comparison with purchasing a building and what the long-term savings would be. And I don't know if that's, also in the cards at all.
Chair Devlin, Representative Dinkelder, my understanding is when the agency was in the process of making the decision, we were directed to move down here. Building a building was not entertained at that point because the desire was to eventually have the agency on the mall. And there was, at that point in time, there wasn't a facility. So I don't think the agency to build a new building in Salem was really one of the options that was really entertained at the time.
And just to follow up,
yeah.
Wasn't necessarily build a new building. It was also purchase.
An existing building. Excuse me. Sorry, Chair Devlin, yeah. Something more. I don't know if we reviewed that as one of the options, but I can go back and check. Okay.
An additional? No. Okay, please go ahead.
So just a couple more items that are in the back of the book. Tab number 7 has some summary information, or tab number 8 has summary information on the economic value of hunting and fishing. In Director Moore's presentation, he talked about a survey that's done nationally. The survey is done every 5 years. The last one that we have complete data for is 2001, and that provides states information on what folks are spending on hunting, fishing, and wildlife viewing activities in the states. So there's some of that more detailed information under that tab. The last year the survey was completed was in 2006, and we don't have data for that survey yet. I don't think it'll be available for a couple more months from the federal government. One of the things we would like to do as a department is try to see if we can get some of that information at a more localized level, which Director Moore did talk about in his presentation as well. Tab number 9 just provides you some background on some of our agency partners. We work with a lot of different state agencies, local entities, a lot of organizations. We have a lot of partnership opportunities with landowners, with the public, and a lot of different aspects of our programs. There's kind of a summary of that information in Tab 8, as well as our latest volunteer report. We have a lot of volunteers working for the department in different areas who provide a lot of hours and a lot of resource to us as far as getting our work out on the ground and working with the public. So that's kind of some of the background and the information in the back of the document that I wanted you to be aware of that's not included in the front part of the presentation. What I'd like to do now is talk specifically about performance measures, and I'd like to do that by working through the detailed forms under Tab 1 at the back of the book. As for some background, the department had a lot of changes made to its performance measures last biennium. We had several new measures added. In fact, we only currently have 3 measures that we've had for longer than one biennium. So as we go through these, you'll find that although we have some targets identified, some of those are still in flux as far as really trying to pin down what we think we can accomplish and how we can get to some of those targets. If you look on page 1 under Tab 1, it does make reference to the benchmarks that Virgil covered briefly. We do link to 4 different progress board benchmarks at the statewide level. They relate to the percentage of monitored freshwater species, marine species, and terrestrial species that aren't at risk. There is also a new benchmark that's under development that has to do with natural habitats. We don't have a performance measure developed yet for that. We'll be working with the Progress Board on coming up with a measure here over the next year or so. So there's still a lot of work going on in both the benchmark arena for the agency as well as the performance measure arena. On page 3 of the under Tab 1, you'll see a list of what our measures look like or our proposed measures are for 0709. There are some measures that we propose for deletion, and I'll talk a little bit about why we'd like to see those come out of our performance measure plan. If you'll keep going through the book and get to page 17, this is the front page of our performance measure report that we were requested to prepare, like all other agencies, for the LFO, for our Ways and Means and Legislative Fiscal Process. If you look at that colored graph on page 16, you'll see that there's a big yellow spot that kind of indicates that some of our measures we're not real clear on how we're doing on progress. We're still sorting out kind of on some of our measures what we need to do to really make those numbers change. But we are making some progress. There are definitely some areas where we need to try and address some of our activities, see if we can have an impact on the performance measures. I'm sure as you've worked with the natural resource agencies in this committee, you've found that sometimes with natural resources arena, since there's a lot of variables in the performance measure area, not just what the agency can do or take action on, but we have a lot of variables around the environment, what animals, issues are, disease issues that sometimes are beyond the agency's ability to control. So there's a lot of aspects to our performance measures we can't really have a a real strong effect on. Our activities are really diverse, and sometimes they're hard to characterize within the performance measure framework. We're making a lot of attempts to try and do that, and you'll see in our measures that we're working on that, and we're trying to continue to fine-tune those to be able to provide better information both to you and to our program staff as they work out in the field. If you would like to flip to page 19, this is our first performance measure. This is a measure that we have been monitoring for quite a while. It has to do with the number of hunting licenses that are purchased. We have had this as a formal measure since 2001, and we would want to continue to monitor this. One of the things we use this for is to try to help us identify if we're maintaining population or game population levels at high enough levels to be able to support opportunity for folks. So they want to buy hunting licenses, kind of back to the question about angling, char doubling. You know, are we providing an opportunity that people want to support those activities and continue to buy licenses and tags? Over time, we have started to taper off as far as our ability to maintain that license purchasing base. That's not unusual, especially compared to other Western states. There are definitely trends where hunting license sales are going down. We are trying to work on recruitment and retention efforts to try and keep people active in those activities. I believe yesterday, out of one of the committees, there's a mentor bill that's being worked that would provide opportunities for youngsters to participate with adults to kind of get their feet wet. Well, I guess it's bad if we're not talking about angling. get their rifles fired and going out hunting with adults. So we're looking at some opportunities to try and see what we can do to keep that license base and provide them the opportunities they want. And like I said, under tab 4, there's more detailed information on the license sale trends. And that's pretty much all I have to cover on that performance measure. I know in past process you guys were covering a couple at a time and then doing questions. Is that how you wanted to proceed, Chair Devlin? Okay. The next measure that we have on here is actually one we're proposing for deletion. It has to do with wildlife viewing. I mentioned that the federal government does some survey work that helps us identify the economic relationship between wildlife viewing and what's going on in the state. And this data is information we get from the federal government once every 5 years. It's not agency-produced information. And I think we found, as we looked at this measure, we felt like it wasn't something we were going to really be able to affect ourselves in terms of changing that, you know, economic dollar amount. So after discussion with legislative fiscal, as part of our performance measure review process, this is a measure we'd like to pull out of our portfolio. as we go into 0709.
Questions on 1 and 2?
Yes.
Yes, Representative Burley.
Thank you, Representative. First of all, I'll take them in reverse order. On KPM 2, I'm glad to hear you're going to propose deleting them because I was curious what
we were
control the department has over personal income. Regarding KPM 1, item 5, factors affecting results, talk about the causes of the variance in the number of tags include but are not limited to, and certainly what you've got listed there are true, but I would submit that one of the other major causes that probably ought to be highlighted is simply the change in the number of hunting populations, huntable populations, and I think that's an important thing. It needs to be highlighted, and we'd like to see that added to the list.
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, that's something we very easily include, and I totally agree that that's definitely an element of what drives people to participate or not participate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question about, I agree that the KPM on wildlife viewing in its current form is, again, not something that the agency has a lot of control over. However, I'm just curious, and I'm looking at the proposed KPMs on page 3, do you have another key performance measure that would be an accurate reflection of wildlife viewing activities? In other words, what I've heard in the past presentations by Virgil is that wildlife viewing is actually the fastest growing part of the activities that are going on in the state. And I can say for my constituents, especially since we are so close to the Swabie Island unit, which I bike by all the time and, you know, see a lot of people there, and it actually generates, I think it's the only unit that actually generates income through its parking permit, that what KPM do we have that would replace this that would be more an accurate reflection of what the agency is doing to promote or capitalize on wildlife viewing, also the connection with habitat, because obviously by enhancing, preserving, improving wildlife habitat, that also adds to wildlife viewing and you know, the facilities that are provided therein.
Chair Devlin, representing Felder. We do not have a major identified at this time. However, I do believe this is an area that our work under the Oregon Conservation Strategy will ultimately find some ways to try and capture some of that information and measure it. That strategy is very new as far as, you know, where we're at in implementing that, but I think that's an area where we will hopefully be able to find some connections between work we're doing under the strategy and what we're getting on the ground, and then what the relationship is with that with wildlife viewing public.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, you're absolutely correct. One of the, I would love nothing more than to be able to annually measure use and participation so we can get that information. It's very expensive to do. That's one of the reasons that information isn't available annually. We have no way to track this group, whereas with hunters and fishermen, we know who they are. They buy licenses. It's easy to survey those folks because we've got their numbers and their addresses. But the wildlife viewing public are much more difficult for us unless we have an entry point such as Swabie Island where we can see things.
Could hardly say you can't go out and view unless you have a license. That would be
well, just a follow-up to that, Mr. Chair, and it may be useful to even just to report on the Swabie Island unit, because it is closest to the largest metropolitan area in the state. It is where you generate income. We can track the number of parking permits or tags, however you want to quantify that. And then if we're looking at expanding that type of program to other parts of the state, you know, you can either extrapolate based on population, or you could say this is a model for other areas where we think there's enough of a market in order to generate that type of income. So I think that would be useful information, especially as that is the fastest growing part of the market, and that's the trend. And I support, you know, I voted for the mentoring bill yesterday, and I support that, you know, we need to address that part. But it's sort of like we have a new paradigm that's facing the state, and I think we need to be cognizant of that and figure out a way that we can measure and then expand on that. And we have to restructure the way we fund our programs. Otherwise, we're just going to have to find a lot more general fund for your agency, and I don't necessarily see that this session anyway. So hopefully we can work on that during the interim.
Just a good suggestion for the vice chair. We could blindfold everyone in Portland and then charge them a license to take the blindfold off.
I don't have any idea what that meant.
I don't either. So you'll have to, for some of us that are sort of, you know, from, you'll have to come and explain that off record.
Be happy to.
Bird watching license?
Yeah, it was like that. Well, Mount Air is probably the biggest part of the state where people go. Birdathon is this weekend, actually.
Well, my neck of the woods has a lot of bird watching, too.
Yeah, exactly. Klamath. Klamath and Mount Air, probably.
They're thinking we can get a fee for that?
Yeah.
God, I'm creating a monster office.
Yes. Okay. I did have one question about the hunting license purchases. I have one family member who's been an avid hunter all of his life, but he's actually in his 70s now, and it's probably pretty rare now. I mean, maybe every 2 or 3 years that he can get some friends to go with him. Do we know anything about the sort of age grouping of hunters? And are we, what are we finding out in terms of the age groupings? Even if we start generating, which is probably a good idea, starting generating more interest with young people, is there a downturn that's inevitable in this?
Mr. Chairman, very definitely so. The research is extremely clear on the dropout rate. Typically, it happens as we see either health issues. The surveys show that health-related issues or that come with age results in dropout somewhere between that 60 and 70 year range. But more importantly than that is loss of your hunting companion or family network. Most hunting is a family associated or friendship associated, and as those relationships fall apart for one reason, because of either health, age, death, whatever the case may be, a partner drops out. We see that drop tremendously between that 65 and 70 year range.
Do we see a lower incidence, though, for particularly certain age groups, like people that are now in their 30s or now in their 40s versus people that are in their 50s?
Mr. Chairman, what we see is the peak typically has been in the 30s, but that has moved forward into the late 30s and early 40s as the demographics of the population, the baby boomers, have moved forward. The median age of the bulk of the hunting population, and they stay active all the way through into their 60s once they've recruited in and have those networks in place.
Oh, that's a pretty good display.
Chair Devlin, members, on page 12 of that licensing report under tab 4, you'll see a graph that shows for both hunting and angling kind of a historical level as well as a more current level. And you can see where the overall trend is dropped, and you kind of see where the bubble of the age groups are.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. How long ago did Oregon start doing the, controlled hunt units?
Mr. Chair, I do not have an answer for that.
Early 90s. And the controlled hunt units are not, every unit in the state of Oregon is not a controlled hunt unit. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, that is correct. There are many general hunts available.
Would it be possible to get a trend of the number of hunting licenses sold broken down by general hunt units versus controlled hunt units? And the reason I ask is a lot of people I talk to, when the controlled hunt was instituted, they just gave up and quit drawing tags. I'd be curious to see if we could break that out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, we'll have to go back and take a look at that. I don't know if we have that information available.
I'm planning on presenting it as part of my presentation.
Got staff right behind me. That covers it. Okay.
Thank you.
Let me go on to 3 and 4.
Okay. Moving on to page 20. Page 21. KPM number 3. This is another one that we're proposing on removing as well. It has to do with the personal income generated by hunting activity, just like the wildlife viewing performance manager. We're proposing that be deleted. Once again, it's information we get from the federal government every 5 years. We don't really have a way to provide that information on a more timely basis at this point in time. On page 23, performance measure number 4 is angling license purchases. This is very similar to our hunting license purchase activity. Same type of information. We are able to pull this out of our own databases because we capture the information with our license buying public. Again, trends in this area are also more flat than those in the hunting arena. But we do recognize that some of that, there's some downturn. We do notice changes in the numbers of licensed buyers when we have a drought season or when we have differences in say, salmon runs. We do find relationships there. We are trying to do some things to maintain a level of the angling licensing public or angling purchase public. One of the things we did most recently was we provided an Easy Angling Oregon Guide, which is a little booklet that provides information on easily accessible fishing areas for families in particular, places that are close by. I think the other day Chair Devlin mentioned, you know, the expense it takes to go fishing somewhere or drive somewhere to get out to a place to go fishing. A lot of these opportunities are close in. They're in ponds that are near cities and towns, and so it's a way to get people out and start kind of starter fishing. Before they, to kind of get people started in their close and inconvenient and very family friendly places to go. We are also doing more surveying of our license buying public to kind of see what opportunities interest them. We've recently completed an Oregon freshwater angler survey about some preferences from that public, and we can try to address those as we develop future fishing opportunities. So this is a major we plan on keeping that we certainly find useful and helps us address our program issues and move into the future. KPM number 5 on page 24. Oregon federally listed species. The percentage of Oregon species listed as threatened or endangered under the Federal Endangered Species Act that have been delisted in last year. We'd like to delete this one, too.
Okay. We'll stop there. Questions on 3, 4, and 5. I'll go right to Representative Burley.
3, 4, and 5. Rather than deleting 3 and 5, that sounds great to me.
Okay. Any additional? Hearing none. Let's go on to 6.
Okay. KPM number 6. This deals particularly with Oregon-listed species. The percentage of species listed as threatened or endangered under the Oregon Endangered Species Act that have been delisted in the past year. This is a measure that we would propose to keep. We are still working on developing targets. This is one that we did start tracking in 2005. It was a new measure last biennium. It's not one we have been monitoring for a long period of time. We think this measure will give us some, over time, provide some information about trends and how we're doing. However, even though we collect the data annually, it's something that is really a long-term kind of trend. It's not something we're going to see go up every 2 years or down. It's really a more of a long-term type of measure. We would like to keep this in place to try and at least address some measurement element related to endangered species, but we recognize it's probably not a perfect tool to really judge how we're doing in that arena. KPM number 7. This is Oregon listed species that were species that were considered for listing as threatened or endangered that were not listed. This one we would like to delete. Compared to the other to the previous measure, the previous measure identifies species that were actually able to be delisted. This measure was attempting to try and identify species that were considered to be listed but that weren't listed because of something we did. So this one, again, is one we were even struggling with trying to identify a targets and progress toward achieving those targets.
Yes, Representative Burrow.
Can we go back to 6 for a moment? You have a federal list of endangered species. We have a state list. How much duplication of personnel effort is duplicated in adhering to both of those endangered species lists?
Sure.
And if you would follow, how much are they coordinated with one another?
Chair Devlin, just for clarification, you're talking about duplication between federal activity and our activity? Is that, or are you talking about duplication within the department with both pieces?
No, between federal and state efforts on endangered species. Because you have two separate lists, many of which include the same, but they're not always the same, how much duplication of effort is there between the state of Oregon and the federal government? Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd like to ask Ron Anglin, our Wildlife Bureau Administrator, to answer that question.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. Representative Girard, there is very little duplication of effort as far as working on species within the Wildlife Division and with the federal government. We do assist them in some cases in working with other state agencies to implement some of the federal statutes, provide technical assistance in meeting some of the federal requirements, whether it's with habitat conservation plans, things like that. But we pretty much step back out of the federal arena. If they're working on it, we just serve as a technical role for private landowners and other state entities in helping them if they have to deal with the federal law.
Thank you.
Who's going? Yes.
Ron, you might want to stay up there. What I'm curious about with KPM number 6 is how. I'm not really clear on how in Oregon we implement our own, the State Endangered Species Act. You know, I mean, it's, I'm presuming it's got different, you know, thresholds and different recovery standards, whatever the case may be. But one of the things in particular I'm interested in is who all is involved with it? In other words, is this something that is exclusively ODF&W, or is it more broadly shared? And the reason I'm asking that is because, again, these measures need to be things that are measuring what is directly within your department's control. And if there's things that other departments have responsibility for in meeting that same goal, we need to make sure that the measure is drafted properly.
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, the way the Oregon Endangered Species Act is written, it does not call for recovery plans for any of the species that are on the Oregon list. It does call, since the revision occurred in the mid-90s, that we develop conservation plans that would keep the species from declining further. I think we've only added two species to the list since that point in time. One was Lower Columbia Coho, and the other was Washington Ground Squirrel, and we did develop conservation plans associated with that. The other way that the Endangered Species, Oregon Endangered Species Act is structured is it applies to state lands and activities conducted by state agencies. So we do consult with and provide direction to other state agencies on actions that they might be taking that could potentially impact a species that is on the Oregon list, and to help them structure their activities in such a way that it would minimize that risk.
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, the authority to add to the list and take off the list, I believe, rests with the commission. They are the decision-making authority under Oregon statute. So in terms of a performance measure, making the determination of whether they go on the list or come off of the list is something that does rest with our agency and our commission.
Sir, that actually triggers two follow-up questions, if I may.
Yes.
Thank you. I thought in 2005 we had to pass a bill to take the Aleutian goose off the list. And if that's true, then why did the legislature have to do that if that authority rests solely with the commission?
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, you are correct. The legislature did pass a statute that removed the Aleutian Canada goose from the list. The way the Oregon ESA is written, it required that we could, beyond a shadow of a doubt, if you will, assure that the reproductive success of a portion of the Aleutian Canada geese could be met and that they were not endangered. And it was the Smedy Island birds, or the birds that winter in Tillamook County. And it's just a nuance within the law and how it's written that because the Smedy Island population has been at risk, when you look at the way the statute is written, we could not remove that bird off the statutes. Even though the Aleutians as a whole had met all the recovery goals, they'd been federally delisted, when we tried to move through the state process, we found that we could not provide the assurance on a subpopulation within the total population of the bird, which prevented us from taking action through the commission to delist it. And we had actually tried that, and legal counsel told us that we couldn't do it. So that's why we came to the legislature and requested that it be done that way. The only other way it could have been done was to go in and try and fix the Oregon Endangered Species Act. And actually, there had been a bill a couple sessions ago that had been reworked to try and do that, and it got mired down and never passed out. So that was one of the things we were trying to address.
The second follow-up question, if I heard you correctly, you said that the Lower Columbia Coho is currently on the state T&E list. And if I'm not mistaken, in the early 1990s, when that was proposed to be listed federally, at that time the National Marine Fisheries Service determined that they couldn't find any genetically distinct segments of that population left, and so they chose not to list it. So I'm curious if the feds couldn't find any genetically distinct wild population of that fish left, why did the state choose to put it on its list?
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, I'm going to have to defer.
Mr. Chairman, if I may call Ed Bowles, our fisheries administrator.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator. Representative Burley, the Lower Columbia River Coho are actually now federally listed. Just over a year ago, the federal government, as a result, in part to federal Judge Hogan's decision in the Alsea Basin, did a status review of all currently listed or potentially listed fish. There's 26 different groups of species that they looked at. Their decision made about a year ago was to include Lower Columbia River Coho as threatened, the status there. So our your question relative to why did we list them when the federal government didn't, we do have within our statute the obligation to analyze that in our own rights. We were requested to do that and did find them at risk at that time in the 90s. We went ahead, as Ron Anglin mentioned, and developed a conservation plan for that, and we're in the process of implementing that when this federal listing occurred. We have now been working since that time, and this was just on the southern side of the river, obviously, state of Oregon. Since that time, we are now working with the federal government and the state of Washington in order to wrap our conservation plan into a federal recovery plan that allows some semblance of a seamless application so that we're not reinventing things as we go forward. That is in process now, and that plan will be done, you know, late this year, next year.
Please go on to the next two.
I believe we had talked about members of the committee. I believe we had talked about six and seven, yes?
Mm-hmm.
And on to eight. Coho hatchery fish. Percent of hatchery coho surviving from smolt to adult. This is a measure that we've had since last biennium and proposed keeping. It kind of relates to our activity as far as looking to see what kind of how our license buying public is responding to our programs. It's an important factor in how we drives angling activity related to the abundancy of fishery resources. The success we hope to have in the area of coho stocking contributes directly to the use and enjoyment of fish by the public. This is an area again where the environment plays a huge role. It's not just what the department does that has an impact on those fisheries, but we do believe there are things that we do through programs in the department that do have an influence on those stocks and how they're able to survive and how they're able to be provided as part of fishing opportunity. This also is an area where we're doing some research that we hope to work with in the future as far as trying to identify better ways to manage those stocks and help those fish. Number nine, commercial fishery. This relates to the economic activity or dollars that are brought into the commercial fishing industry related to personal income. As opposed to the measure related to the wildlife viewing and hunting economic activity, this is one we would propose to keep. It is one we've had since 2005. Since we do have specific information about how we issue those permits and licenses, we know who's buying them, we know what they're landing, we have a lot of information about those publics and what they're doing as far as the industry. We do believe that we can use this information to kind of see how we're doing as far as the opportunities we provide and make available to the commercial fishing industry. Again, this is an area where those commercial fishing landings change based on environmental conditions. There are good years and bad years, as we all know, and we want to use this to help monitor the activity and see how we're doing. So that's number eight and number nine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Number nine, so help me understand how the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has direct cause and effect relationship on personal income of commercial fisher people.
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, I don't believe we set the value of those fish in the market. However, we do provide the opportunity via the permits, and we are able to, because of the way the program works, we can identify what those folks receive in the market. I don't know that we control what they get, but it does help us to be able to identify how the industry is doing and whether or not the steps that we take and the actions the commission takes are helping or hurting that industry?
Well, I absolutely agree with what you're saying, but I think to label personal income as a target for the agency or department is not looking at what you actually have control over. And I would, you know, I don't know how you define it, whether it's tons of fish, which you really don't have control over either, because that's obviously you're subject to some very, you know, wide swings in environmental conditions. But this is just one of those measures that I don't think is really indicative of the department's efforts. Now, of course, if I'm wrong, which I very well may be, then I would like to submit that we add one for the Department of Forestry, that they have something similar to commercial logging.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, real quick, one of the reasons why Representative Burley, those economic indicators are in there is, if you remember, our mission statement for food fish as well as for sport fish has an economic optimization clause in it. And one of the economic outputs is personal income. It can be measured as value of X vessel landings that they're paid for, but that figure is much smaller and doesn't really reflect the economic benefits that derive to the community. We could do it by pounds. We could do it by what they pay when they land it. It's all directly related to the management actions and the allowable harvest, the optimum harvest that's available to those out there. And some measure is appropriate. It just depends on which measure you want to pick.
Of course, we've had controversy along in my neck of the woods between farmers and fishermen in regards to salmon, but certainly the amount of money, emergency money, that was pumped into the area for commercial fishermen primarily might be some kind of a measuring stick as to the economic benefits of commercial fishing in Oregon. It's been a very difficult time for both parties.
We're probably going to go on about 4 or 5 more minutes, and my problem I'm having is I've lost about 2/3 of my committee. It's still signing out here.
I got a 9:34.
Yeah. And so we'll stop after probably the next two. Okay.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee. KPM number 10 relates to wildlife damage. This tracks the number of wildlife damage complaints that we address annually. I think we control that. It's pretty self-explanatory. Our goal is to work with landowners in both urban and rural areas to make sure that we're trying to help them address wildlife damage issues. So that's pretty much what that measure shows. If you look at our target and our actual data, we're pretty much staying on track with trying to deal with those complaints. The next measure is at the bottom of page 29 and page 30 is KPM number 11, Oregon Species of Concern. This has to do with monitoring, what we're doing to monitor species of concern. It relates directly to Oregon benchmark number 85, which is related to the percentage of monitored freshwater species not at risk. This is a measure we've had since last biennium with proposed keeping, both for the benchmark and for our performance measure. Since this both are relatively new, there are still benchmarks and targets, or benchmark targets as well as performance measure targets that are being refined. We continue to track what we're doing as far as monitoring activities for those species. So that's number 10 and number 11.
In ours, it's...
And 12 and 13 are similar.
Yeah.
Yes.
Why don't you go ahead and do the remainder?
Okay, we'll do... And like Paul just said, number 12 and number 13 are very similar. They're just for different species. 11 was for freshwater. Number 12 is for terrestrial vertebrate species. And number 13 is for, I'm skipping ahead, sorry.
You're skipping ahead. There's three of them.
Sorry. Can I go too fast? So 11 is freshwater species, 12 is terrestrial vertebrate species, and...
Different. Where's
that one?
11 is freshwater, 12 is terrestrial.
Yeah. And then number 13 has to do with our fish screening program. and that tracks the number of unscreened water diversions, and we're trying to reduce that number. We want to do more screening and have more of those that are covered, so you'll see those numbers drop. And if you look at that performance measure, you'll see we're on target to try and keep up with that work. Questions on any of those species or the fish screen performance measure?
Go ahead.
14/15. We had two separate performance measures related to customer service. We'd like to combine them into one. The distinction between the two previously, which one was overall customer service, the other one was in specific areas. So really, we've combined this information. We did our first customer survey related to this performance measure back in the spring of 2006. That is the data you see on the chart. So we propose keeping this measure. Our plan is to go ahead and repeat the customer survey every 2 years. We're targeting four different areas as far as staff, agency customers. We target commercial license holders, people who have been working with us on wildlife damage, landowners enrolled in the landowner preference program, and then sport license holders are the kind of the four populations we targeted as trying to get customer service information from them. The last measure we proposed for 0709 is not on here. It's the best commission best practices measure that's being implemented for all agencies with commissions. So that's something we'll be working on with the commission over the next 2 years, or that's our plan. So that's pretty much performance measures.
Okay. Any questions? At this time, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing. Tomorrow, we'll start right at 8:30, get as much done as we can.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The House is in session at 8:30.
I was going to say something about well, given where we are in the session, we'll probably still just start at 8:30 because we won't get many additional days. So we'll start at 8:30. If it does take us any additional time next week, we'll do public testimony on the day that we actually have public testimony scheduled and then go probably one day extra if we have to. Okay. And with that, we're adjourned for the day.